Welcome to the Shift Extension Paramedic Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by our show sponsor, Explorer Risk Medical. Explorer offer unique CPD adventures for paramedics, nurses, and doctors. You can learn about altitude, dive, tropical, or remote medicine whilst exploring some of the most picturesque locations in the world. So if you want to take your CPD out of the classroom and on an adventure, head to their website, www.explorerriskmedical.org. So we're back for another episode of What Would You Do If with Matt and Nick. Matt, what's today's topic?
Mate, thank you for having me back again. Today we're doing What Would You Do If... it's a dysrhythmia. I'm sorry, I tried to come up with like a funny little title. I had to go who bumped his head. But I couldn't do it. It's just, I couldn't come up with anything. Sure. So it's just it's a dysrhythmia. We're talking about dysrhythmias.
Well, we've got about 45 minutes to talk about it. So maybe you'll come up with a better title in the next period of time. So this little series that we're doing, well, it really came from when Matt and I were having a coffee and he wanted to pick my brain about some questions that he had regarding his clinical practice as a paramedic. And we had this really great conversation and you were able to really just be very curious about why you did things or why things were the way they were. So we thought, hey, this was a really great conversation, a great learning opportunity. So let's put it into a podcast and share it with our audience. So that's kind of where all this came to be. So Matt, dysrhythmias. Ask me anything and I will try and give you an answer. If not, I'll refer to my colleague, trusted colleague Google.
Yeah, up to date.
Up to date, yes. Up to date's great. Do you have an up to date?
That's amazing, isn't it?
Do you have a subscription?
Yeah, I do. And mate, did I tell you about up to date when I was down in Melbourne, how it used to be used?
No.
I can't remember if I told you this. When I was a uni student doing my undergrad degree in paramedicine down in Victoria, I was working in the ED at a local hospital and they had one of the computers was permanently affixed to a wall and just always logged into up to date and sitting there. And it was the up-to-date computer. And all the doctors and nurses, anyone could just go and look stuff up on up-to-date. And they really encouraged it because they were like, it's good medicine for you to be revising things.
That is fantastic.
Which is, it's good, isn't it? And I really liked it too because it got me in that mindset early on of, okay, I don't have to have memorized everything. It's okay to look things up. It's okay to check. You're only human.
Yes.
So I like seeing that recognized that, you know, in an actual leading ED as well.
Fantastic. There's nothing wrong with getting your phone out at 3 o'clock in the morning when you can't remember something and looking it up. It's good for patient safety. So we certainly encourage it. Maybe we should get an up-to-date subscription for our Shift Extension audience.
I swear we are not on the payroll of whoever owns up-to-date. They're not like, they're in the background just throwing money at us. I wish.
Oh, mate, that'd be great. If UpToDate would like to sponsor the platform, feel free to reach out to us. I think that's good for everyone.
Good.
Let's do it. All right, dysrhythmias. Dysrhythmias. Let's do it.
So, mate, I want to talk about, again, it's a hypothetical patient who's kind of loosely based off patients who I go to every once in a while where I'm just not 100% sure about what I'm doing. And these are ones where we're talking about primary dysrhythmias. So you go into someone, you turn up on scene, you do your initial assessment, and the main thing that's going on, as far as you can tell, is a dysrhythmia. So it's not secondary to toxicology. It's not due to an MI, but you can certainly mention if that's something you're keeping an eye out for, that kind of thing. It's just a dysrhythmia that's popped up for some reason. And I want to start off by talking about a patient I've been to a few times, which is a middle-aged woman who calls you out for palpitations. You get there and there is a fast, wide rhythm. And it looks at first glance like it might be a VT or it might not be. That's a patient I've been to a couple of times, always puts me in palpitations when I see that on the screen because I'm just aware that it's bad and dangerous. Now, I actually want to start off by asking you something a little bit more basic, which is before we hit the point where we've got the ECG, I just want to ask you about lead placement.
Yes.
Can I ask you, as a senior CCP, someone who's done, I assume, at least 10 to 15 ECGs in their career.
17.
Are you? 17. You probably did 17 on your shift yesterday. Do you find that our lead placement is good? Is it bad? What are we doing well? What could we improve on? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that we're pretty good at lead placement. I know that when we started it during our training at university, it's a lead on the left leg, and it actually went onto the leg, and the arm leads went on the arms. And that's great if your patient is lying still supine on a bed and you could get a nice clean tracing. But obviously, there's some constraints and challenges associated with the environment for which we work in. So we adopted the ability to take that four-lead ECG by placing the dots on the thorax, either below the clavicles or on the side of pelvis. And that seems to work pretty well. I think where we really need to focus on our landmarks is on the placement of the 12-lead, because getting that right is going to give us a really accurate picture. And just taking that little bit of extra time to make sure that we're putting those dots in the right location. The same principle can be applied when we talk about pad placement as well. I think sometimes we rush that because we come across a patient that's potentially in cardiac arrest or might be peri-arrest, and we want to get those pads on nice and quickly to be able to treat any lethal arrhythmia we might find. But in doing so, sometimes we just slap the pads on and they end up on the clavicle or a bit too low, maybe around the kidney. And we just need to take that little
bit on the forehead.
Maybe not that far. That's a little far. But just taking that little bit of extra time to make sure our pads are in the right position and they're well adhered to the skin, because that's going to increase our chances of a success if we need to defibrillate our patient.
I love the idea that I'll be able to turn up on scene and you'll turn up and I'll go, yep, Nick, don't worry. We've delivered two shocks to the kidneys. They're well and truly being defibrillated.
You Fantastic.
Can go, great, cool. We can all relax, guys.
Fantastic. It's a new trial.
Now, mate,
trying it.
Yeah, yeah. The kidney trial.
Yeah.
So when you're getting there, one of the things I see is patients generally are wearing clothes.
Yes.
It's just perpetually a problem I come across. And some of the paramedics I'm with go to the effort of getting a patient to fully remove their shirt. Maybe not if they're female, remove their bra, but really exposing the chest and having that good view. Other paramedics I'm with will kind of just lift up shirts and then reach in kind of semi-blindly and take a pretty decent guess at where the electrode would be going. What do you do? Are you in the cohort where once you've got enough experience, you can actually just place it pretty well? Or is it something where you need to be exposing people the whole time? What's your day-to-day?
I think if you can accurately place those dots in the position that they need to go in without removing all their clothes, that would be ideal. Because remember, we've just met these people. We're in their home 10 seconds ago or 1 minute ago. We were, hey, my name's Nick. Nice to meet you. The follow-up sentence may not be comfortable for the patient if the follow-up sentence is, please remove your shirt. So I can understand how for some patients that would make them uncomfortable. And we want our patients to be comfortable with us, because then they're more likely to buy in to our care and trust the process and us within that process. So if we can achieve that placement with keeping their shirt on, fantastic. But obviously that's a challenge in some situations, and we do need to remove that clothing. But if we're going to do so, there's a few other things we can do just to make it a bit nicer for the patient. Ask people to leave. You might ask some of your crew to just step outside. There's some cultures that don't feel quite comfortable having that level of exposure with men in the room, and that's fine, and we just need to respect that. So just thinking about those other aspects of it to make it as comfortable for the patient as possible.
Mate, that's absolutely fantastic. Great information. Thanks, dude. And next question I want to ask you is about females specifically. and breast tissue.
Breast.
Do I have a lisp? Did I just get a lisp?
Possibly.
Breast tissue. I was taught back in the day at uni that either is okay. You can go over the top of breast tissue, or you could go underneath. And I was also taught that women generally prefer electrodes just to be placed on top. What were you taught? What's your knowledge about this? Does it matter if the electrodes go on top or underneath? And should we be aiming for one or the other?
I think everyone's anatomy is different. Sometimes when you go underneath, it changes the kind of vector or the way in which the lead is looking, right? So rather than looking horizontally through towards the heart and creating that kind of three-dimensional picture, it might pull and look upwards or downwards, which is going to change the ECG that you acquire at the end of the day. So sometimes if that occurs, you need to go over the top to get that accurate lead placement. It's going to be difficult. Obviously, you can't palpate through, say, V3 around to V5 because of where the tissue is. You're not going to fill those rib spaces, but you can have a reasonable idea of where it's going to be. So I think you just have to be just, it's a patient-by-patient situation. Both can work. Just be careful of going underneath and changing that position too much.
Fantastic. That actually reminds me of one of the more embarrassing mistakes I made when I was a uni student, and I was trying to place a 12 lead, and I was absolutely fixated on getting my anatomical landmark straight.
Perfect,
and I was trying to palpate, you know, the intercostal spaces. But this poor lady, I must have been pushing quite hard, and I think it was actually really painful for her. Anyway, lesson
that's all right.
Learned.
You got to learn some way.
I know. Just terrible. Can I ask you another one on placement as well, which was I've kind of been given two conflicting bits of information about V456, which is your fifth intercostal space for all three of those. Now, I don't know about you, but if I actually feel my own ribs, they move upwards as they bend around the chest. It's not flat. But most of the diagrams I've seen about 12 lead placement simultaneously say, just follow the curvature of V5, but then they'll also have a diagram where they're all just in an exact
horizontal
plane line.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, what's your knowledge about that? Does it matter? What's correct?
I don't know which one is correct, to be honest with you. I think they're both reasonable.
I'm gonna have to Google this later. It's really,
you know what? Jump on Up to Date, see what they think. If Up to Date doesn't,
I'm telling you, dude. I'm feeling my own ribs right now, and there's quite a bit of curvature. It's got to be over a centimeter that it's moving upwards. This must look so weird in your,
this is why,
in your Zoom.
This is why it's a podcast, not a video cast or a vlog. Right? You'd just be seeing a video of Matt touching his ribs. It's not for everyone. It's not that bad. But to be honest with you, I don't know. I'm not sure. And I don't think it would make too much of a difference. I think there's too many other things and other variables at play between tissue and anatomy and adhesion and the monitors that we're using. I just don't think it would make too much of a difference. But, you know, we'll have to get an electrophysiologist on the show.
I know, get someone who actually is a pro with this. I guarantee they'll be telling you we'll be doing everything wrong, right?
Oh, yeah, they'll have a conniption.
Okay, so we've taken our ECG. We see we have this fast, wide rhythm. For me, that's always a moment where I go, oh, that's not good. The second you see that, what are the first things that you'll start doing if you're there? Do you start looking at whether the patient's stable or unstable? Do you start doing additional OBS? What's next for you once you see that ECG and you have that uh-oh moment?
You want to see exactly what the rhythm is, but I don't think you really need to deviate away too much from your systematic approach. So you still need to put all the pieces together within the puzzle. So you still need to get a really good history from the patient about what's happened, their signs and symptoms, their medical history, their allergies, what they've been doing today, has it happened before. Do a really good physical exam of the patient as well is really important. So I think it's really important not to get like too fixated on one part of the larger clinical picture. So you need to have all that information, because if you don't have all that information, then it can change how you treat that patient. and you really need all those pieces to make the best decision about how to move forward caring for that patient.
Fantastic. So I don't have to go, all right, I've got 10 seconds to do something or this patient's dead.
Because let's say this patient's in VT, but they're sitting there and they're talking to you. They're probably not going to die in the next 20 seconds. And if they do, just put the pads on, defibrillate them, and there's a really good chance that they'll revert. Okay, so...
Do you, if you go to someone who's in a conscious VT, do you put the pads on preemptively?
I do, yes. Yeah. As part of my global management, I'll pop the pads on that patient because there is a chance that VT will become a non-perfusing VT at some point, and then we can defibrillate that patient in a timely manner.
I was about to ask you about whether the pads are the same pads used for cardioversion, but I've just realized we'll get to that later on.
Yes.
So you've got this fast wide rhythm. You take your time. You do an assessment from the patient. And then you come back to the ECG and you're looking at an ECG and it might be a VT or it might be an SVT with aberrancy. Now, I suck at this. I was not taught it in my undergraduate degree. I've tried to teach it to myself a handful of times and it's just really hard. Look, when you're there... What do I need to know, I guess, as a run-of-the-mill paramedic who's trying to work out what rhythm this patient has?
So I'll let you in on a secret, Matt. I suck at it too, right? And I think what you're referring to is something called the Wellens criteria, which is a criteria to aid a clinician in differentiating between a patient with ventricular tachycardia and a patient with SVT with aberrancy. So they both look like fast and wide rhythms, but one can be an SVT and one can be a VT. Now, usually SVTs are narrow and fast and VTs are wide and fast. And that's a really easy way to kind of differentiate between the two. And sometimes the history helps as well. Patients who have a history of SVT will say, I've got a history of SVT. And that's a great indicator as well. But sometimes they might say that, and let's say this lady's saying that, oh, I've had an arrhythmia in the past and I see a heart doctor for it. And once they had to zap me, and that doesn't really help us differentiate down. The criteria I like to use, it's not really a criteria, but you can look at some of the history. So there was a study done a while ago and it looked at some of the associating factors that come alongside a patient with VT. So if your patient's over the age of 35 and they have a cardiac history, so they've had an MI in the past, there's like a 94, 95% chance it's VT.
That's really, really good information. And I suppose it kind of makes sense too.
It does.
Because if you're going to someone who is... No. I was about to say something and I've just realized it's actually not.
Well, so the Wellens criteria is there's about 6 or 7 parts to it and... they're sometimes quite difficult to interpret. None of each of those criteria is very sensitive for differentiating between the two rhythms, right? So you can do the criteria and you put a few things together and you go, well, it might be, it might not be, but we still don't really know. It's a bit of a, it's a diagnostic or it's a differentiating aid, not necessarily a slam dunk per se, right? But really? At 3 o'clock in the morning, I can't remember all those things, but I can remember 35 in cardiac history. That's a good start.
That's a really good start. I'll tuck that away.
But the worst part is I'm going to be that age in 2 years' time. So if I end up with a fast rhythm, I'm like, it might be VT. I'm a bit worried.
Oh, my God. We're the same age, dude.
Are we?
This is so depressing for me because you were just so far ahead in life.
No, mate. I'm, you're doing a PhD.
I've spent so much time bumming around.
There's nothing wrong with being a bum, right?
I was one of my favorite phrases about aging was I've recently heard from Dr. Sandy McQuarrie.
Yes.
If you know Sandy.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine.
And he was on your podcast.
He was.
I think that's Oh my God, I'm actually about to quote your own podcast back at you. Oh. I've just realized that's where I heard this quote.
Yeah, go on.
This is so bad. He described his age, you know, in his 50s as being in his angioplasty years, which I just loved. I just realized that was actually on an episode of The Shift Extension. I forgot that when I started the sentence.
I don't remember that. I don't remember him saying that. I'll have to go back and listen to the episode. So, well, there you go. There you go. If you haven't heard,
listen to your own episodes every day.
No, I don't. But if you haven't heard, head back to our catalog and listen to Dr. Sandy McQuarrie.
I actually will randomly toss that out there. If you haven't heard it, that was one of the best podcast episodes of anything that I've ever listened to.
There you go.
Sandy talking about his own death, which is just out of this world. It's a whole other thing.
It's a good, it's a very good story.
So
back to our lady.
So we've got this. Yeah, yeah, back to our lady. So we've got this middle-aged lady. She's had palpitations. We've gotten there. It might be VT. It might be an SVT with aberrancy. Eunuch, who's our ICP, arrives on scene. What are your treatment options and how are you choosing between them?
So let's say this lady is in SVT, right? The easiest low-hanging fruit way to correct this is a modified Valsalva. All right, so modified Valsalva is essentially we're getting the patient into a certain position, getting them to bear down and blow into a tube, and we're changing the intrathoracic pressure to increase the cardiac output and then essentially promoting the vagal tone within the heart to get them their heart rate to slow down is the nuts and bolts of it. It's good because it's not really invasive at all. It doesn't require drugs. It doesn't require electricity or sedation to achieve it. And it's quite successful. About 43 to 50% of all patients in SVT who have a modified Valsalva will revert with it. The challenge is patients who are in a SVT who are shocked, they don't really revert very well and they can actually make their shock worse. But for the well hemodynamically stable SVT, it can be quite successful. And a lot of patients with recurrent SVT will actually know how to do this themselves. And sometimes they'll seek assessment by paramedics or at a hospital because they've tried it 3 or 4 times and it's just not working. Anecdotally, I have also found in the past, if you have a patient who's, you know, their blood pressure is a bit saggy, they feel dizzy when they stand up, getting some intravenous access, giving them a fluid challenge, 500 mils to a liter, and then trying a Valsalva, I have found effective as well. And or well, sometimes just some fluids helps as well. So if you're looking for like low-hanging fruit, reasonably simple ways to fix this, then yeah, those two things. Give them a crack.
Can I tell you about a funny patient that I went to last year? Mm. It was an SVT. We didn't do the Valsalva because I was a little bit concerned about them being slightly unstable, but we were transporting them in. And they started to yawn. And while they were yawning, we went over a pothole and they kind of gave a big like cough. And they coughed themselves straight back into a normal sinus rhythm. And I got the entire printout on the ECG and was able to show it to the physicians in the hospital.
Yes. That's awesome.
It was just brilliant.
Some patients will just revert like that. You know, you place an IV in and they revert. They walk down the stairs. They revert. They get a fright from their dog and they revert. So don't be surprised.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
So we've got our Valsalva as one of our options.
Yes.
If it's one of those patients where they're not suitable for their Valsalva for whatever reason, maybe they actually are a little bit shocky and you're concerned about doing anything like additional vagal stimulation, that kind of thing, what are your options then? Because Valsalva is the only treatment that I'm authorized to do as a run-of-the-mill paramedic. What do you bring to the table? Why do I need you, Nick? Justify your existence.
Justify my wage. Well, your other options on the table for these patients is cardioversion. And there's two ways you can do that. You can do it chemically with drugs or you can do it with electricity, right? Chemically, the common drug that's used is something called adenosine. Some paramedics use adenosine. It's used more predominantly in hospitals. Essentially, it stops all electrical activity through the heart and allows the heart to just reset and its natural pacemakers to take over. It's got a half-life of 6 seconds, right? So if you give it through a peripheral IV and you don't flush it properly, it'll stop working before it gets to the heart. So what you have to do is put a large bore cannula in an ACF or as proximal as possible, and then you use a three-way tap. So you eject, and then you turn a tap, and then you eject a flush so you can get it up into the heart before it stops working, all right?
That's amazing. That's so interesting. I didn't know any of that. Yeah.
And so that's your first option. Or your other option is to do it with electricity, right? And that's why sometimes if you have a really sick patient who you're not really sure if it's like SVT with aberrancy or it's VT, and they're not shocked for any other reason like sepsis or a PE or an MI, you know, they're shocked because of their primary arrhythmia, the treatment is the same. It's both electricity. So sometimes differentiating between the two rhythms isn't as important. Someone else can do that. Cardiologists can do that down the track. But essentially, electricity is your option. And why would you cardiovert someone outside of a hospital? Generally, I look for patients who are shocked or have some form of cardiac dysfunction. So the heart's not handling being in a rhythm that fast. So shock, or like a really bad chest pain, or like a pulmonary edema or heart failure that's occurring alongside it. Okay. They're the patients I'm looking to identify as patients who would benefit from having this procedure done in their living room versus waiting 20, 30, 40, 50 minutes to have it in a hospital. If they're compensating well and they look well and don't have any chest pain, then take them to a hospital. It's a safer place to have the procedure because at the end of the day, it's a procedure.
Fantastic. So if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So it's when they're decompensating or when they're looking a little bit worrying, that's when you're going to start doing stuff.
Correct.
Hey, is this the kind of patient where eyes are run-of-the-mill paramedic, see something that's fast and wide and should just routinely call for intensive care as backup? Or is it something where I go, are they stable or unstable and then call for backup?
I think it's reasonable to get a second opinion no matter what context you work in, because these patients they're not simple patients. Whether that's you're working for an ambulance service and you have another clinician come out, whether you're working in a clinic and you have access to another clinician like a remote doctor or telehealth, I think there's value in getting another opinion, because it's not just about the management, but it can also be about what else is driving it. So some dysrhythmias may be caused by like a thyroid storm, right? Or some bradycardias might be caused by hyperkalemia. And just getting some buy-in from another clinician about this patient, their assessment, and what we should do for them. And there's value in that.
Fantastic. Love it, mate. And I'm so sorry if you can hear my dog in the background.
I can't hear at all.
Oh, that's so good. Because she's annoyed because I'm not paying attention to her. It just feels cruel. All right. So we've got our SVT patient. We treat them, we fix them up, and they're looking good. I'm actually just going to leave the SVT poster there. You fixed them. Congratulations, mate. Good one.
Yes. We fixed her. Fantastic.
Absolutely brilliant. So you've got your... sorry, I should check. Is there any other random info about VTs or SVTs you want to toss out that you think's good to know before we start on slow rhythms?
No, not really. I think the other one that we see a lot of is the patient in rapid AF.
Oh, great one. This is a patient I go to pretty regularly, and I don't know how serious it is. When I go to a patient in rapid AF, what am I looking for and what do I do about it?
Well, I think the AF patients, like there's a cohort of AF patients that have their first presentation of AF, and there's a cohort of AF patients that are in a rapid response who have a pre-existing diagnosis of AF. The patients I think we see are the ones that have pre-existing AF and they're having a rapid episode. And a lot of the time that is being caused because the body is being stressed by something else. There's another stressor at play. And this can be caffeine, can be alcohol, it can be a lack of sleep. It can be, I've recently had surgery, or I've changed my medications, or I've got an infection, or I have an electrolyte imbalance, or I'm having an MI. So the body's being stressed by something. Our value is being able to identify what that stressor could be. And that's the challenge with AF, is that you get these patients who have rapid AF, and let's say they have a blood pressure of 70 on 40. And we say, let's consider cardioverting these patients because they have a fast rhythm that's causing shock. But the problem is, the shock may not be a consequence of the rhythm. The shock might be a consequence of the stressor that's put them into the rhythm, such as sepsis. And then we go and give them drugs. So to cardiovert someone, essentially you need to give them some sedation so they don't remember it, because it's quite uncomfortable and painful to be defibrillated. And then we're potentially giving midazolam, fentanyl, other medications to someone who's septic to fix a rhythm that's being driven by a stressor. You know what I mean? So that's with these AF. Yeah. The important thing with these AF patients is to identify what the stressor could be and then treat that.
Fantastic. I mean, it's terrifying to hear the first three things you mentioned were caffeine, alcohol, and lack of sleep, because that's just my normal lifestyle. I just remembered one other question I wanted to check as well. Cardioversion.
Yes.
We're using the same pads that are used for defibrillation. It's just lower joules on a particular point in the cycle. Is that right? Or am I missing something there?
So sync cardioversion is about providing defibrillation, okay, electricity across the heart to depolarize the heart at a certain period within the phase. So we're syncing on the R wave, okay? Because if we don't sync on the R wave, then we could put the patient into VF, essentially. Most defibrillators will do this automatically. Some won't, and you actually need to press sync on the machine to make it sync. Otherwise, we're just pressing defibrillation, and then we can put them into VF. But if you do, it's not the end of the world. You just shock them, and happy days, right? You're just shocking them twice instead of once. But please, that's not me promoting tardiness. Let's make sure we do our processes really, really well to prevent that as much as possible. But essentially, it's the same pads, the same process. You're giving a lower joulage. So you start off at 100 joules. Most of the time that works. Some patients need a bit more. And then we're also, as part of that, essentially doing a procedural sedation to make them not aware of the procedure, because it's quite uncomfortable. And that procedural sedation is very similar to the one you would do for, say, a sedation with any other agent, whether it's like ketamine or propofol or droperidol or midazolam or anything like that. It's a reproducible process.
Absolutely fantastic, mate. Love it. So let's say that's all great info. I'm really happy. Another patient that I go to every once in a while, where I'm a little bit iffy about what to do, is, again, we'll just say middle age. We'll mix it up and say a male, just to make it a bit different. Mm-hmm. And you go there and their heart rate's just a bit slow.
Sure.
And I find these quite tricky, because if the heart rate's really slow, like, I don't know, 30 or something, I'll go, okay, I'm going to request an ICP, you know, whether they're conscious or whatever, however they're perfused. I just go, okay, that's slow enough that I worry. But when the heart rate's a little bit faster than that, but still too slow, that's when I really get a little bit uncomfortable about whether or not I need you there. So I know every patient's different. There's not going to be a blanket rule. But as some kind of an idea, how slow is too slow in your books? And this is for a patient who's not an athlete. It's not that kind of thing. But are we talking 50? Are we talking 40? When would you start to worry or start to go, yeah, I should be on scene for that one?
Well, there's no like golden number, right? It's not like if your heart rate is 42, everything's okay. But if it's 41, the world is crumbling around us. You know, generally speaking, some patients can tolerate heart rates between 40 and 60 very normally. Like your fit athlete can be at 44 and that's fine. But then you can have a patient who's comorbid at 58. That's not okay. I think you have to more broadly look at your patient about what's happened, the associated signs and symptoms that they have, kind of put it all together. And what's particularly driving it?
There was an urban legend that Lance Armstrong used to have a resting heart rate in the high 30s or something.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
I don't know if that's true or not. No? It's just something I heard.
I wouldn't be surprised. And I think like there's a cohort of these patients you see, and they get to older age in the 70s to 90s, and their heart's pacemaker just decides that it doesn't want to work anymore, right? It's been going for a few beats over the many years, and it's decided that it just doesn't want to work efficiently. And these patients, you know, they might present by having a few syncopal episodes, or they're getting dizzy, or they can feel the heart beating really slowly. And then you put them on an ECG and you see that they're in some form of AV block and it's going quite slowly. Their heart's just a bit clapped out and needs a bit of help, usually in the form of a pacemaker.
So let's say that you go to someone and they are a little bit unstable and their heart rate's slow and you want to speed up their heart. What are your options? Because I can't do anything here as a run-of-the-mill paramedic. I don't have any treatments for bradycardia. What do you carry in your kit bag?
So there's a few options. Fluids can help. And then there's a few other medicines.
I said I didn't have any treatments. I guess I do have fluids.
Yeah. So fluids can help. It's about treating what's kind of driving it, right? So if you have a patient who's got a heart rate of 45 because they're having an inferior MI, fix the MI, fix the heart rate. If you have a patient who's got a heart rate of 45 because they're hyperkalemic, you need to fix the potassium. If you've just got a patient who has an undifferentiated low heart rate, one of the first medications you can use is atropine. And essentially, atropine, what it does is it blocks all the parasympathetic activity within the heart, so allows the sympathetic activity to be unopposed, allowing the heart rate to increase. From there, your other options are drugs, things like isoprenaline, which a lot of pre-hospital services won't carry, but some do. Or you can do pacing, which is kind of similar to, it's similar in the sense to cardioversion, is that you're providing electricity to manipulate the heart. But the idea is that you're providing a similar electrical impulse to replicate the heart's natural pacemaker to speed up its rate. Now, it's important to note that you'll speed up the rate, but you won't necessarily change the stroke volume. So you manipulate the cardiac output through manipulation of the rate, not the volume being ejected.
Can I check? Yeah, and this is really interesting because one of the fun facts I learned just a few weeks ago is that people's stroke volume will naturally reduce as they age, and someone who's 80 years old, their stroke volume will only be 60% of what it was in their prime. Mm. So super interesting to hear you say that. Atropine, not something that I carry or give. You said that it blocks the parasympathetic system. So I'm guessing it's an anticholinergic or something like that.
Correct.
Am I right in kind of, this is probably going to sound super, super dumb, just for my simple brain. Could I just kind of think of it as being like ipratropium bromide of the heart? Like it just blocks the...
Sure. Yes.
Yeah, awesome. Cool. That's going to make it easy for me to remember. Yeah. That's some really good little summary of all those treatment options. I want to ask you about AV blocks.
Yeah.
Because I see heaps of first degrees. And every once in a while I see, some second degrees or even like a completely stable third degree or something. Mm. When do blocks matter? Which blocks do I need to worry about or not worry about? What do you think about when you see blocks?
So I think, it's not the end of the world to be able to differentiate between the different type 2 blocks and an advanced type 2 and a type 3 block. It's not the end of the world. It's more about how it sits globally within the patient. So someone could be sitting there with a type 3 block and be sitting up, walking and meet you at the front door and great, fantastic. Versus someone who's in a type 2 block who's passing out every, 5 minutes because their blood pressure keeps dropping, right? Or their cardiac output keeps dropping. So I think don't get too caught up about being able to specifically differentiate which one it is. But obviously, the more advanced block, the more of a challenge it becomes in regards to managing them. more so at the hospital. And it can influence sometimes your disposition. So some patients may benefit from going to a place that can provide a more advanced cardiac intervention if they do have like a more advanced block. But my theory is, you know, take them locally, get a full assessment done, and see what's driving it, and get some cares done at the local hospital before you think about maybe taking them somewhere else.
Fantastic. I really like it. So again, it more comes back to that, are they stable or are they unstable, rather than is it this rhythm or is it that rhythm?
Yeah, pretty much. And that goes with all the ECGs. Like, you know, I remember I used to spend hours and hours trying to figure out or to learn, to rote learn all these different ECGs and like left anterior fascicular blocks and axis deviation and differentiating different bundle branches and all that.
Definitely about to ask you about axis deviation. Well, yeah, anyway, sorry.
You know, and that's great. If you can sit down with any ECG and get that right, you know what? High five, crisp high five, power to you. Well done. I am in awe because I can't do that. I can't retain all that information long term. And there's nothing wrong with getting your phone out and jumping on my favorite website if I need a little bit of quick information is Life in the Fast Lane, right? LIFTS.
Good, isn't it?
It's great. And if you haven't heard of Life in the Fast Lane, it's a website that essentially has a summary for everything, but it's a summary. So it gives it to you in dot points. You don't have to look up an article and pull out the results and then make a decision. It just gives you like really quick dot points of what it is, what it looks like, signs and symptoms, treatment, disposition, for pretty much anything you can think of. So if you're like-
It's like a free, simple, up-to-date, really, isn't
it? It is. I love it. So, you know, if it's, you know, if you're tired and you can't think, you're like, oh, it looks like a fascicular block, I'm not sure. Google left anterior fascicular block, Life in the Fast Lane works a treat, because it's hard to remember all the rules. And the thing is, ECGs, they're not black and white rules. Everything's up to interpretation of the clinician. So if I give one ECG to five different cardiologists, I'll probably get six different answers, right?
Yeah, so, I've heard that saying. It's a great one.
There's no right or wrong. I wouldn't get too caught up in it, to be honest with you.
Brilliant. Absolutely love it, mate. And you mentioned axis deviation before.
Yes.
Now, this is really interesting for me because I was taught this at university and I've now hit the point where it's left my brain because I just wasn't using it. And it's just up and away. Because it was one of those things where you can calculate the axis deviation and, you know, left or right or whatever is kind of associated with some conditions and not associated with others. I just wasn't using it regularly and it wasn't making a big difference to my treatment. Look, how important is it for, am I about to get fired tomorrow for admitting that? How important is axis deviation for someone at my level in particular?
I think for... Oh, that's my cat. Can you hear that?
I can't hear your cat, but I can hear my dog.
It's 6 p.m., so my cat's demanding dinner. She's giving me a dirty look. Look at that. She's like,
that is not a happy cat.
Look at her. Just wait your turn, mate. She's going to break something later. Axis deviation. Oh, that's right. We're talking about axis deviation. Look, I don't know, mate. To be honest with you, it's great to know, power to if you can. And yes, it's associated with some conditions. It's not a slam dunk to anything. It's not like a ST elevation in MI, right? It's not going to necessarily change anything. It's just as part of a larger picture that you're trying to build of your patient. So if you can find it, great. And I encourage people to try and expand their knowledge and to be able to understand these things. Do I lie in bed at night worried about the fact that I can't think of it at all times? No.
Brilliant. Mate, that's absolutely fantastic. You've put my mind at ease. Once again, I'm here worrying about things, not being sure about things, and a lot of those things kind of don't really matter a huge amount pre-hospitally. They're nice to know, but they're not necessary to know. Mate, I think that was the last question I had. Did you have anything else on bradycardias or irregular rhythms you wanted to toss out into the world?
No, I'm pretty happy with that. I think at the end of the day, look at the patient holistically. Don't just get too anchored on just that ECG. It's about everything else that's going on. So don't lose sight of all the other aspects of your patient assessment, of your history taking, of your physical exam, because that's just as important as the ECG that's in front of you.
This is great. And I'm so glad to hear you say that I don't have to go out and learn Welland's criteria because, oh man, the anxiety I had coming into this episode.
I just can't remember it, to be honest with you. Maybe my brain just isn't quite, in my 30s, isn't quite what it used to be.
I don't think Dr. Welland can remember Welland's criteria.
No.
So that's, that's great to hear. Mate, thank you so, so much for your time. As always, I really, really appreciate it.
I love these episodes. These are great. These are really good. And I like them because it allows our listeners an opportunity to be curious. So if you're curious about something within your practice, write to us. You can find us online on our website, www.theshiftextension.org. We're on socials, Instagram, Facebook. If you see us in person, come and say hi. And if you've got a question you'd like us to answer on the series, what would you do if? Please write to us, let us know, and we'll make an episode. But until next time, Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate, as always.
Mate, you almost forgot we have a telephone number as well.
Do we?
Yeah, 000.
don't call 000 for us. But if you do.
I mean, do if you need to.
If you do.
Not a theory question.
If you're in a tachy or bradyarrhythmia, please call an ambulance. We would encourage that. But to find us, nah, it's not going to happen. But until next time.
That's it. That was the last bad joke I wanted to toss in before we finish the episode.
I like it. That was good.